Washington, D.C. suburbs of Montgomery and Frederick counties and all of Washington, Allegheny, and Gary counties. Congressman is the only former CEO of a publicly traded company serving in the U.S. House and brings to Washington an extensive experience as a successful entrepreneur and private sector and nonprofit leader. In 2017, Congressman Delaney was named one of the 50 of the world's greatest leaders by Fortune magazine. The only member of the House of Representatives to make that list. That's pretty impressive. As the son of a union electrician, John grew up in a blue-collar household. Scholarships from his father's union, IBEW Local 164, American Legion VFW, and the Lions Club allowed John to attend college. He was a graduate of Columbia University and Georgetown University Law Center. Business builder, he founded two New York Stock Exchange listed companies before the age of 40, and is a past winner of the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. John spent his business career starting and running successful companies and helping small businesses grow. His companies were both founded in Maryland. Capital Source, which Delaney launched in 2000, became a public company in 2003, lent money to thousands of small businesses around the country, and has been recognized by the Treasury Department for lending to disadvantaged communities, while also receiving numerous awards as one of the best places to work in the Washington, D.C. region. John is Chairman Emeritus of Capital Source. Prior to Capital Source, he founded Healthcare Financial Partners, a successful company that was started in 1993 and became a public company in 1996. John and his wife, April McLean Delaney, have made community service a priority, especially in the field of education, the provision of core services and issues affecting children. They are generous supporters of the public interest law initiatives at Georgetown University Law Center, where they endowed the Delaney Family Professorship in Public Interest Law and have funded significant scholarships for students' interests in public service. As a former public lawyer, I say thank you. John is a member of the Board of Directors of Georgetown University and the National Symphony Orchestra, was the past chairman of the board at St. Patrick's Episcopal Day School, and was a past member of the Board of Directors of the International Center for Research on Women. His wife, April, is an attorney and education and children's advocate in the nonprofit sector, and she currently serves as the Washington Director for Common Sense Media, a nonprofit dedicated to educating families on social media technology and digital literacy. The ladies are members of the Little Flower Catholic Church in Bethesda, Maryland, and longtime supporters of Catholic Charities. They have four daughters and live in Montgomery County. Congressman Delaney's primary focus in office is to restore our nation's economic competitiveness so that we can have a strong middle class, raise our standard of living, and expand the number of good jobs available to Americans. In 2011, he founded Blueprint Maryland, a nonprofit dedicated to invigorating Maryland's private sector. Blueprint Maryland gathered business people, educators, labor representatives, and policy experts together to chart a way toward a high-tech, high-information economy. Congressman, I hope I haven't stolen your speech. But okay. Well, we are honored to have Congressman Delaney here with us.
For having me, and I apologize for sending such a long bio. I thought I would lose half the group. No, it was good. Thank you very much, Bill. And thank you all for having me. It's really great to be here with you this evening. And I want to congratulate all the awardees. If you're still here, June, are you still here? And Charlie? Congratulations. And the county, of course. I love how you had everyone up on stage here. It was like one of those Academy Award moments. Everyone crowds behind the picture because they want to be on television. So it's really great to be here with you. And I also want to thank all the volunteers that are here this evening, because as all the elected officials in the room know, none of us would have the privilege of doing what we get to do for a living, but for the fact people like you go out and do all the hard work that gets us elected. So we're very grateful. And I know there's a lot of candidates in the room here today, and I admire the fact that you're throwing your hat in the ring. It's important work. It's a really important time to do it. And, you know, we all know we're in a tough spot as a nation. in a really, really tough spot, which is why it's so important for us to think differently about our party and about politics in this country. And I don't think we're in a tough spot across the long term. I think the hand that this country has, relative to any other country in the world, in some ways has never been better. But right now, we're in a really tough spot. And I'm not just talking about the man in the wings. Right? Obviously, that's the punctuation in many ways, in my opinion, everything that's wrong with politics. Because hyper-partisan politics is tearing our country apart. It's dividing communities. It's even dividing families. How many of you know families, maybe even your own family, where people have stopped talking to each other because of what happened in the last election? I mean, we all know we're supposed to put, right? We all know we're supposed to put country ahead of party, but for God's sakes, we should put family ahead of party. But that's where we are right now. And maybe the biggest problem with what's happened in politics in our country right now is that it's stopped us from doing anything. We're frozen, and the country has so many large-scale opportunities and so many significant challenges to overcome. But we're doing nothing about any of them, and we haven't done anything about these things for decades. And as you all know, and I know from my own lives, the cost of doing nothing is not nothing. And we're paying a very, very high price as a country right now because of our inability at the federal level to actually do the things we know we should do, to actually have a discussion about the things we agree on, as opposed to always talking about the things we don't agree on. Because that's what politics has become. It's become a giant discussion about all the things we don't agree on, instead of spending any time talking about the things we agree on. And look what's happened. Across the last several decades, the economy in this country has fundamentally changed. You've seen it here in Iowa, I've seen it in Maryland, everywhere in this country. The economy has changed. And the world has increasingly become sorted out by the winners and losers in globalization. And it's made us question whether we made the right decision to become part of the global economy. Of course we made the right decision to become part of the global economy. But where we made the wrong decision, or I would argue the immoral decision, is not to do anything as a country to deal with the communities and the individuals who we knew, or we should have known, would have been hurt by this decision. And we continue to this day to talk about it, and we don't do anything about it. And it's going to happen again. If you go outside of politics and you talk to people in the business community, in academia, in the nonprofit world, they're obsessed with how technological innovation, automation, artificial intelligence is fundamentally changing everything. It's changing society, it's changing the work. It's going to change the jobs of the future. It's changing our demographics, the security risks we face as a nation, how we use our resources. Are we having any of those conversations in politics? Are we doing any of the things we need to do to better prepare our country and its people for this world? No. And what's really at risk is the thing that maybe is most central to who we are as a people, which is this notion of the American dream, which is if you work hard, and you play by the rules, next generation can be better than the current generation. 60% of the kids in this country under 18 live in a county where there's absolutely no evidence that there's economic upward mobility. So one would argue that for 60% of the kids, the next generation, the generations to come, we're writing them off. And this is really personal to me, as it is for so many of you, because I've lived the American dream. I grew up in a blue-collar household. My dad was an electrician. He was a union electrician. I heard some applause for the IPW. Life wasn't fancy at all, but it was good. When my dad worked, which was most of the time, he earned enough to support us. When he didn't work, he had health care. Right? So we never thought about health care. And when I went to college, when I went to Columbia University, that union paid for half of my tuition every single year. But that was the social contract back then. You work hard, you play by the rules, your community and your country support you. I remember when I took my first company public on the New York Stock Exchange. It was 1996. I was 11 years out of college. I was the youngest CEO in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. And I was going into that amazing building in Lower Manhattan. And I looked over my shoulder across the Hudson River, and I saw Jersey City, New Jersey, which is where I'm from. And I remember that Union Hall, the IBEW Local 164 Union Hall, where I would go every year and thank those electricians for giving me a scholarship. But what they were really giving me was an opportunity that none of them have. Not one of those people in the room had that opportunity. I'm sure things like that have happened in this room. But they were happy to do it. Right, I could see Ellis Island, where one of my grandparents was detained as a boy. He was 10 years old. And the reason they detained him when he came into this country, they let his brothers and sisters in, but they detained him because he had one arm. And back then, we didn't let people into the country who were disabled, because we said they couldn't contribute to our society. So we stayed there for a long time and didn't have an appeal in front of the judge. And as he used to tell at the Thanksgiving table, the judge walked in, put on his robe. My grandfather saw that the judge had one arm. And he used to say, that's when I knew I'd beat America. Right, but that's the way the country, and many of you have very similar stories, if not even more dramatic. But that's the way the country used to be. Work hard, play by the rules, and shop for a better future. But that's not alive, and it's not resonant in the United States of America today. And in my opinion, the reason is because we don't do anything. We're frozen. And the Democrat Party, which is the party that believes that government can and should do transformative things to make life better for our citizens, should be the party that leads this country back towards civility and power, back to a world where we have some respect for the notion of public service. Think about all the wonderful public servants in this room who you've heard from tonight. The fact that the country doesn't respect the contribution that these people make to society, how did we let that happen? This is an enormous opportunity for the Democratic Party. It's not only the right answer, clearly, by any measure, but it's a huge political opportunity because the country is crying for this. They want the fighting to end. They want us to come together. They want us to get things done. And we can do it, right? But we have to start talking about our fellow citizens as if half of them are not entirely wrong about everything they believe, which is kind of what we start to do as political parties. We have to start talking more about getting rid of insidious forces like gerrymandering that pervert the political system and bend it away from the will of the people. We have to get the money out of politics. Right? The next president should commit to only do bipartisan things in the first 100 days. Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't it be amazing if the next president said, I'm actually going to first focus on the things we agree on, and we're going to get some of those done. And then we can start working on some of the harder things, like how we take 60% of this country that has been hollowed out by changes and do the kind of things to make sure capital, both private capital and public capital, flow to these communities. Because the one thing I learned as an entrepreneur is nothing happens unless someone invests. And what's happened in this country is capital has left parts of this country, and a lot of capital has been invested, but they just haven't been in the same places. And we've got to rebuild our country. We'd be spending more money on infrastructure. I've got a $1 trillion bill in the Congress that's bipartisan, 40 Democrats, 40 Republicans, that spends $1 trillion on infrastructure and pays for it entirely by fixing our international taxes. We should create incentives for private enterprises to invest in parts of the country that have been left behind. There's bipartisan ways of doing that. The federal government should only be contracting with companies. The federal government's the largest buyer of goods and services in the United States of America. It should only be contracting with companies who do a disproportionate amount of their business in counties that are economically deprived. We can reverse these. There's $3 trillion of unrealized capital gains in the United States of America. People don't want to sell their stocks because they don't want to pay the capital gains. We should say, fine, sell your stocks. You can defer those capital gains for 10 years, but you have to invest your proceeds in economic opportunity zones that we're going to set up, which are the places that have been left behind. We can do this. And then we have to prepare our country for the future, right? We need an entirely new social contract. The social contract that existed when I was a kid needs to change. The educational system needs to change. K-12 was a remarkable innovation after the Industrial Revolution. but now pre-K through community college, right, or skills training should be the basic right every citizen has. Healthcare should no longer be linked to employment, because as long as it is, it'll be bad for healthcare and bad for employment. Retirement shouldn't be linked for employment, because as long as it is, it'll be bad for retirement savings. Right, these are the things we need to do to prepare our citizens for a world that's going to change. They're going to need 3, 4, 5 jobs across their lives, not one. They need to be trained on an ongoing basis, and there's smart ways of doing that. This is the hard work we need to do. But before we do this, we need to actually start getting some of the easy things done. And the way to do that is to bring the country together. And that's what the Democratic Party should stand for. Trump won the White House for 2 reasons. The first reason was Democrats didn't turn out. And I think we've learned our lesson. There's a lot of energy in the Democratic Party right now. The resistance movement and everything that people are doing to fight Trump is the right answer, and we need to make sure that carries through. But there's another reason he won. There's a lot of Democrats and a whole bunch of independents voted for him because, as hard as it is for us to believe, because I've never met him, but I think he's the most narcissistic person I've ever observed in my life. So it's hard for us to believe this, but a lot of Americans thought he was going to fight for them. And he weren't. So we cannot win by just saying how bad he is. That's not a formula for success. We've got to fight him when he does things wrong, which is about every 15 minutes. But we also have to talk to the American people about what they care about, not what we care about.
Yes.
Yep.
I love the Democratic Party to my bones, but we are the party of 1,000 flowers blooming. We have so many issues, and we're right about the overwhelming majority of them, but a lot of people don't care about them. What people care about, and you know this, because you talk to your friends and your neighbors, the people you go to church with, the people you work with, at the end of the day, they care about their job, the dignity of work, their pay, and the opportunity for their kids. That's what they care about. Every time the Democratic Party is not talking about those is a missed opportunity. Because we're right on these issues. We're right on these issues. So if we want to return this country to the land of opportunity, right? If we want to return this country to the place where the grandson of the one-armed immigrant who worked at a pencil factory his whole life, and the son of the union electrician and parents that didn't go to college will have the opportunity to start 2 companies, take them public on the New York Stock Exchange, serve his country, which is the greatest privilege I've had in the Congress of the United States, and have the opportunity to run for president. If we want to be that country, we have to start talking to the American people about what they care about. And what they care about is they want us to come together, right? Because we have, as a nation, kind of almost an inexplicable link to our government. We're proud of our government. We're proud of the good and noble things we have done across history. We identify with it. It was this amazing experiment that worked. And when it's failing, and when we lose confidence and faith in our government, we lose faith in our country, and we lose faith in ourselves. And if the Democratic Party is the party that can lead us out of this to the world we'd like to have again, government, then man will win every election. Because that's what the country is. Thank you for having me. I don't want to take too much of your time, but God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.